I'm going to carry on a bit from where I left off yesterday. What is the theme of all, the fundamental theme of all soap opera? And if you just think of the TV soap operas, any of you ever watched the TV soap operas? When I was a young monk, I never had really. When I was a young monk, we went through a period where we watched them every day after lunch. We watched the day, we actually watched the Days of Our Lives. That's how I know about the Days of Our Lives. This went on for several months. And Reverend Master was, it was very enjoyable for the community. I have to say, we had a lot of good laughs. But Reverend Master was trying to, I think, show us what soap opera is, how you make soap opera, you know, how you make soap. And I think that went right over most of our heads. I certainly didn't mind. I didn't have a clue why she was having us watch soap operas as part of our training in the monastery. But I trusted her, and it was all good fun. But, you know, when you're really enmeshed in soap opera and a worldly attitude of mind, you don't tend to recognize what it is necessarily that the master is trying to point out about it. But, you know, looking back on it many years later, and, you know, what is the kind of common theme of all soap opera? The common theme. Well, I won't do a quiz here. It's love. Love is the theme of all soap opera. And love is also the theme of all religion. So it ain't all that different. It's the main difference. Well, there's two main differences. One is that the level of love that one is seeking. The level of love that one is seeking. And the other one is in the means by which you seek it. And if you've ever watched the soap operas, and I really encourage you to take a few minutes and do that sometime. It's in the actual means of trying to get the person you want, hold the person you want, prevent other people from getting the person you want, and that's soap opera, you know. But in the means to it, there's a lot of conniving, deception, gossip, constant gossip, constant talking about each other is the main thing going on there. Constant talking. There's a little action in the modern soap operas. There was virtually none in the old soap operas. It was all, but mostly it's still just people talking about love, about getting the person they want and how awful they feel about losing the person they want or they had. It's all about that. And I'm not saying this in a mocking way. Please understand, I'm not saying it in a scornful way. I'm just saying that this is a fact. Watch the soap operas, you'll see. And that is human life right there. That is life in the realm of human, fairly accurately depicted if you simply leave out the spiritual element altogether. That's what you're left with. It doesn't matter your society, your tribe, your epoch or period of time. It all comes down to that. There are many different vehicles, some of them very, very weird from our point of view, but you have to realize that from other people's, other cultures' point of view, some of what we do is incredibly weird. And they're just as right as we are. And just as wrong as we are about it. But it's all about love, about human love. So that's the theme of the soap opera. And the means tends to be very non-perceptual, basically. Non-perceptual. And of course, there is a more perceptual way of finding human love and treasuring human love, and in a romantic kind of relationship, that tends to be via kind of a honorable kind of courtship and an honorable kind of partnership or union or marriage, where people are taking responsibility and being faithful. And again, this transcends cultural. There's different ways of understanding that. You know, different cultural ways in which it manifests. But, you know, faithfulness and trust and these things that transcend these cultural limitations. And when it doesn't exist, or when it's very minimal, then you have, you know, sometimes whole tribes or whole cultures being kind of crazy, really. That does happen in some cultural settings, where a whole bunch of people can be kind of loony together, because they do not trust one another, they are not faithful in their love, they're not responsible. People can share that, and they can also share a much more meritorious approach to life. You know, in taking refuge in the Sangha, one thing we're doing, we're trying to hang out, so to speak, with people who are responsible and who understand how powerful love is, and it has to be treated with great care and with fidelity and faithfulness and in a perceptual way. And then we're here just, you know, talking about human love here. But just as human love and the acquiring and not losing of human love is the theme of soap opera, so, you know, divine love is the theme of religion. And divine love includes human love. Because love with a capital L excludes no love. However, again, human love that is not responsibly practiced, you might say, becomes a great detriment to the experience of divine love, the recognition of divine love. Because one gets oneself in such a jangly, confused mess, you know, kind of stuck in a kind of glue. If you kind of look at, you know, again, turn on TV sometimes and watch, you know, 10, 15 minutes or half hour of a soap opera. I really could recommend half hour, an hour, you know. Stick to it a bit, you know. Commit yourself a little. But it's like watching people, it's like watching flies in flypaper, kind of. It's glue. It's watching people stuck in glue. And again, I'm not saying this in a scornful or mocking or, you know, but from a spiritual point of view, it's watching being stuck in a kind of glue. And you have to say, why can't one of these people ask themselves, is this all there is to reality? Is this all there is to life and to love? Because it's so manifestly transitory. The person that you have, well, you know, here's another thing. Take any one of the soaps and watch it for 10 minutes every month. You'll see that, you know, one of the characters is blissful when you turn it on 1 month, and another month is in hell because they lost that person. They lost that person. They got kidnapped. You know, they drowned. You know, the best friend ran off with them, whatever the story is, the little story is, you know, and it's a good little picture of impermanence. And of course, it's just what happens to human lives. You're sailing along, not a care in the world, and then you stub your toe over one of life's little stones, and all of a sudden, you know, you're flat on your face in the mud. And you can't see any light anywhere. And of course, this predicament is the reason for religion. This predicament is the reason for religion. Something in us longs for something that is more real than that. And it doesn't have to despise that to long for what is more real. That's the problem with asceticism. You know, it goes too far. You know, asceticism is a kind of a religious disease, and its response to human love and to the normal idea of what is a refuge in human life without religion is to scorn it and to want to just be rid of it. But no one actually gets off that easy. We have to make our peace with the love of man as we find the love of God. And we cannot scorn or despise any part of ourselves in that process. And anything that we scorn or despise in another, we are scorning and despising in ourselves. So, human love is not the obstacle. It's simply, in the end, it's not enough to satisfy the deepest longing of the heart. And that is the real meaning of dukkha, or suffering. The real meaning, the real spiritual meaning of dukkha is not just that it's pain, which is the normal way that it's expressed. Life is pain. The real meaning of dukkha is that nothing but the love of the eternal is enough for the human heart, for any being. And that is the real meaning of dukkha. That until the heart is locked onto the eternal and knows and is living and training with the love of the eternal, there is a dis-ease within the human heart, an unsatisfied longing. And this is simply a it's intrinsic to our nature. You can't change this. Only the eternal can satisfy our longing for the eternal. Within the flow of existence, time, within the flow of immaculacy, you know, living beings come to experience this longing as a deeper form of that same longing that leads us to fall in love with another human being and to cherish another human being. And we come to recognize the love for and the love of the eternal as the deeper abiding love that shines through or reveals itself through all of our transitory loves. When I thought back about the talk I did yesterday, I don't believe I even mentioned the word love once. I thought, well, that's as good as far as it goes, but it's not really addressing the real issue. Because I can only take a step at a time, so I'm sure there's some reason for that. But this flow of immaculacy that I'm talking about, it is the flow of the love of the eternal. And it is manifest in all of existence. This is why Dogen can say, and truthfully, that there is no difference between samsara and nirvana. But I mean, how can that be? You know, we're supposed to be seeking nirvana and escaping samsara. But of course, it doesn't really pan out like that. You've got to find it where you are. Do all beings possess the Buddha nature? And looking for it outside ourselves or in another situation than in this situation and another being other than within ourselves, you know, we're just setting ourselves up for a perpetual chase after emptiness. Remember, Master used to say you can trail your hand in a river, and while your hand's in that river, you know, your hand one with the river, one with the stream. You feel the water flowing. As soon as you grasp after it, grasp the hand of water and try to pull it up, you've got an empty hand. And that's what the flow of immaculacy is like. You can train yourself to bow moment to moment, accept, bow, and constantly adjust to changing circumstances with a positive attitude, and learn to see the Buddha within each aspect of the changing circumstances, the Buddha within this person, within this event, the teaching that is there, the compassion that is there. Or one can go chasing after a future state of affairs that even if one finds it and attains it, it will be another passing event. No external refuge is an enduring refuge. This inexorable fact is itself the manifestation of compassion, because eventually it throws beings back upon their own heart. When you've done enough chasing after the external and it's simply never satisfied, then eventually all you're left with is listening to something within yourself and turning within. And that's what meditation is. Meditation is going to that deeper place that underlies all the changing surface appearances. And that in that deeper place then, one can begin to recognize one's own longing for the eternal. And one can really embark on the adventure, the most amazing adventure which a human being can do, which is the adventure of spiritual transformation that happens as all of the externalized longings coalesce, draw together, and then burst upwards to the eternal. And then flows down again in compassion for all living beings, making a complete circulation. The coalescing and rising up, the recognition of the eternal, the falling back down like the waters of a fountain of compassion, and the gathering again in the basin, as it were, then the rising up again, making a great, magnificent circulation. That I myself think of as the great circulation, capital G, capital C, of the water of the Spirit and of the spiritual life. So all the kind of surface stuff is still happening up at the surface. And it's just as much a part of the ocean as any other part. And it is the surface. It is possible to live from a deeper place than the surface. And that's why we meditate.